Even before the Valdez, however, Exxon had been a place that emphasized procedure and cultivated orthodoxy. With the inauguration of OIMS, the I-Dotters and T-Crossers rose to predominant authority. Because of the nature of its business, Exxon's recruitment was biased toward engineers, scientists, accountants, and personalities who were often trained to be comfortable with rules, people who were pleased, even eager, to work for one company all their lives and to move from place to place in its service. Senior executives noticed that employees tracking for management tended to reach a point, somewhere around 4 to 7 years after joining the corporation, when they either committed to Exxon or left. Those who stayed did not find OIMS ironic or extreme. They liked the culture of discipline and accountability. Restless free thinkers and habitual dissenters who accidentally got hired, often as scientists, tended to decide quickly that they would be happier elsewhere. The result was a corporation led in its upper management ranks by people who were not only supporters of the OIMS reforms, but true believers. Around an industry conference table, Exxon's delegation usually dominated. "You don't like them, but you respect them a lot because you know that they're really smart," said a competing executive. An Exxon delegate to an industry committee meeting typically arrived with a binder full of research, colorful PowerPoint slides, and carefully outlined remarks that reinforced the impression that he was the smartest guy in the room. Exxon's sheer size meant it enjoyed advantages of research and scale. If Mobil dispatched one lawyer to an industry conference, he might arrive to see two or three from Exxon across the table, shuffling through the papers they had spent many hours preparing as a team. The ultimate measure, and the chief purpose of this management culture, was Exxon's financial performance. Even during the early Lee Raymond era, a time when oil prices gyrated disruptively and at one point fell to historic lows, the corporation's performance was superior from quarter to quarter and year to year. Exxon earned $6.47 billion in profit in 1996 on $110 billion in revenue, more profit than any American corporation that year except General Electric and General Motors. Mobil, the next largest American oil competitor, posted about half of Exxon's profit margin. Exxon made more profit on each dollar it invested than any of its American or international competitors. Its exceptional ability to complete massive, complex drilling and construction projects on time and under budget meant that, in comparison to industry peers, it remained exceptionally profitable in recessions and boom times alike, when oil prices were high and when prices were low. The Exxon way came across as arrogance to many outsiders. Raymond once stepped before a large conference of Wall Street analysts and announced, "What you're hearing today may seem boring. You'll just have to live with outstanding, consistent financial and operating performance." As to the performance of Exxon's competitors at Chevron, Royal Dutch Shell, and British Petroleum, Raymond added, "I have to say, I am surprised at the apparent lack of focus." Exxon's attitude toward the other majors has always been, "We are oil, the rest of you are kids," said a long-tenured executive at a competing company. Exxon became such an oft-cited antagonist in this oil man's household that once, when the industry seemed troubled, his daughter asked him, "Dad, do you think things will get so bad that you'd go to work for Exxon?" "No, I sure hope not," he answered. Rockefeller Goodwin, a descendant of the founding family who became a critic of modern Exxon management, acknowledged that the company enjoyed a strong corporate culture. Unfortunately, it includes a lack of interest in listening to outsiders, an assumption that they know the answers. The shareholder activist Robert Monks, another persistent critic, found Exxon managers self-referential and good operators but not good citizens. A senior civil servant who worked on international energy issues at the White House recalled, "It doesn't take you more than 5 minutes dealing with Exxon people to kind of get the full 2x4 across the head sense of some of their culture because of their blunt directness." Engineers and financial controllers influenced the corporation more than its global business strategists or brand marketers did. The latter tended toward habits of dreamy ambition and improvisation difficult to reconcile with OIMS. By the mid-1990s, Exxon operated in almost 200 countries with about 80,000 regular employees. Overseas, 98% of its employees were non-American. To operate such a business in proximity to the sorts of daily risks illuminated by the Exxon Valdez grounding did require strict discipline. "We don't run this company on emotions," Lee Raymond liked to say. "We run it on science and principles." He sought the relentless pursuit of efficiency, he once said. As Standard Oil had discovered a century earlier, however, the larger, more profitable, and more powerful Exxon became, the more it attracted attention as a political actor. And in politics, discipline, performance to budget, and error-free design were not common qualities. Instead, there was a surfeit of human factors in the OIMS vernacular. As Exxon rose to greater global influence in the early 21st century, the corporation's leaders persistently struggled to find a supple human touch.